Welcome. It's so nice to see you. Thank you for making the time to show up for this conversation with Nicole Atkins to talk about her book, Book of Boobs, A Visual Journey Through Breast Cancer. Nicole and I know each other because she is a graduate of our meditation instructor training program. But that is just a small part of what she does in the world. She has over 20 years experience in social justice advocacy. She is a yoga guide and meditation teacher coming in through the waiting room. And she's also good at doing things that are scary. We were just talking about this while we were waiting to begin. She's good at taking chances and putting herself in positions where she has to grow. For example, she was just telling me she just started improv classes, which is incredible, and took on an elected role in your sorority, for the region of your sorority, which I'm sure has a lot of responsibility. And she just works in social justice advocacy. So that is confronting fear, I would say, is my guess, every day for more than 20 years. And so the moment I saw this on her Instagram, Book of Boobs, I pushed purchase because I was just so proud, if I may say, and also touched by the subtitle, A Visual Journey Through Breast Cancer. So for people who have had cancer, breast cancer in particular, the questions, I'm going to turn it over to Nicole in a second, the questions that I would imagine asking are, what really happens? What does it really look like? I get what my doctor is saying. I get what Dr. Google is saying, which you should always ignore probably. But what is it like for a real person to go through this experience? And Nicole had the courage and generosity, I would say, to answer that question. So I'm really happy to have this and to share it with anyone I know who faces this experience. And now I just will turn it over to you, Nicole, if you could share with us what you would like about this book and open up the conversation. Yep. Are you muted? Let me get you unmuted.
Thank you. I had muted myself and I was like, I'm not going to be able to get off again. Like the door locks, the child poop door locks. Good evening, everyone, or afternoon, depending on where you're from. So I guess we could get started and talk about why I wrote it. I was diagnosed with breast cancer, I guess it was 5 years ago now. The math gets fuzzy with the pandemic and with counting, you know, when you're out of the woods as it relates to being diagnosed. But when I was diagnosed, and I was trying to quell my fear of the unknown. And for me, when I have more information, the more information I get, the better I feel, whether that's rational or not, it makes me feel better. And so I was Googling, you know, okay, they say I'm going to have to get radiation. What will that look like? They say that I'm going to have chemo and my hair is going to come out. What will that look like? And I couldn't find anything, right? I Googled and I couldn't find any images. I couldn't find any, because I needed visuals and I didn't find anything. And if I found something, it didn't suit me. It didn't suit my hair texture or my skin tone. And so I was like, well, let me begin to take pictures throughout this. Some inner knowing was just like, just take pictures, right? And so as the book has, there's some books, pictures in the book where I thought I was cute sometimes, and there's some pictures in the book where I was sad. I think it was just a journal for me, a form of journaling through photos that allowed me to just capture it and reflect back after I was a little bit, I could look in the rearview mirror a little bit. And so that's why I wrote the book, because I had no intention of writing the book. Like, I just had intentions of taking a bunch of pictures and slapping them together. That's it. That's it. And as it progressed, I had to give some context, or I had a remembering and I was like, oh, this is really something that happened and I want to share. And it's not pretty. I cuss in the book. I share things that don't maybe show me in the best light, that maybe doesn't show some people that I love in the best light, but not in a bad light. Just, you know, people want to be remembered or spoken about in flowery ways, and I'm not a flowery person. So it's very straight to the point. Susan, did you want me to answer anything specific or go in a particular direction? Because I can.
Yeah, no, I'm just curious what it was like to actually see it come out in print.
Oh, boy. Mortifying. It was mortifying. First of all, who asked me? Who asked me? Second of all, my literal boobs are in the book. It's not like Playboy, but it's like gratuitous, but my literal boobs are in there. And they don't look that great. I mean, you know, aesthetically, in terms of what society tells you good boobs are supposed to look like, there's some, you know, they're, let's start off with this. My back is a 32, a D cup. I'm a small frame. My boobs don't sit up here like people portray boobs to sit up. My boobs are natural teardrops like most people who have boobs. And so I didn't have a high, I didn't appreciate them. Let's just say that before I was diagnosed, I didn't appreciate them like I should. I even toyed with maybe I should get them lifted, whatever, right? And I was 45 when I got diagnosed. So if that gives you any idea of like where you're at. And so I don't have any kids. I had never been married. And so that's what you're starting with. You're starting with somebody that's 45 who has a touch of maybe some perimenopausal symptoms, you know? And then I got diagnosed. And we can get into to that later. And so having all of that, writing the book, then seeing like, oh, people are going to actually see my boobs. They're going to see the burntness and the yuckiness. They're going to see my actual boobs. They're going to see me. I'm not a like out there person. I'm working on being more open to share, not for the sake of sharing, but for the sake of connecting with someone else who may have a similar story. And my words can put meaning to what they're feeling. And that's very scary. And then I go back to, didn't nobody ask me? Nobody asked me. And so that's the scariest part. Like, nobody asked you. Who cares? Like, so that's what I felt putting it out. Like, oh, my boobs are going to be out there. People are going to look at me weird. That type of stuff.
Yeah. Well, Book of Boobs. You kind of know what you're getting just from the title there.
That's why I made it that title. Yep.
It's the best title. And what kind of response have you gotten?
So it's odd. And I don't want to get all weepy or whatever. But like this morning, I woke up to a text. Because a good friend of mine bought the book, gave it to someone who had just had a mastectomy. And I'm trying to find the text, but I don't know if I can find it. And I just woke up to a text and it said, thank you for your book. My supervisor, whatever, I won't say her name, gave me the book. I just had a mastectomy and it was easy to read. And thank you. Just, I woke up to that this morning.
That's so wonderful.
I was appreciative. I said, thank you. If you want to vent or whatever, feel free to drop me a line. And I've gotten other similar texts, like a colleague I used to work with. He bought it and he said, I've only read the first 40 pages, but how brave. I'm proud of you. And it sounds like you. It sounds like you. And so, yeah.
That's what makes it so powerful. And by the way, if you're listening and you want to ask questions, please raise your hand or your digital hand or your human hand or put your thoughts in chat. And that point, it sounds like you. That's what makes it so powerful. It sounds like a real person.
Yeah.
And that there's nothing more comforting in the scary situations of our lives than to encounter a real voice.
Yes.
So I really, really appreciate that. This may be a silly question, and feel free to say it was completely didn't help. But did you find that your background in meditation or your experience with yoga, what if role, if any, did those things play in this process?
Yes. And so not in a like, oh, yoga, pretty, just, no. In that, coincidentally, I was in the middle, smack dab in the middle of a graduate program for spirituality, culture, and health with a concentration in holistic healing. Now, if that's not a like, whatever to you, I don't know what it is. In the middle of that program, I got diagnosed.
Wow.
So there was something, a knowing that I had that this mind, body, and spirit thing, that's a thing that doesn't get enough play. And so I happened upon this program that I won't go into the long story, but, and I meant to get the certificate. Someone said, oh, if you apply for the program, you can go for free. Hence how I got in the program. And I graduated, and then I got a second master's in spirituality, culture, health. But I thought it was profound. And I thought the research, which there's a lot of research, I'm 51, by the way. But there's a lot of emerging research that has been done in the last 20 or 30 years that neuroscience and all the good stuff that talks about the connection between the mind, body, and spirit. Spirit isn't defined specifically. There are different definitions of spirit, but so something that intrigued me about that, hence why I got into the program. But to have a lived experience about how to apply the things that I was learning in the graduate program. I had done yoga in the past, but had not got immersed. I call myself a yoga guide. I don't like teacher because I don't like the power dynamics of the word teacher and instructor. So I'm a guide because the yoga practice, my philosophy, it is your own. I am just here to guide you and make suggestions and offerings of movement and breath and, you know, stillness. It's why I chose guide. I know that's, you know, just something I came up with. But going through that experience, having done yoga in the past, being a little familiar with stillness, because I was familiar with prayer, contemplative prayer, being still. And, you know, I don't know how many people cuss, and I don't know how many people had a background I had, but I'm 51. And so my mom or my grandmother, somebody old would say, sit your ass down and be still, which that's a whole nother conversation. But it was sit down and be still. Sometimes it's okay to sit down and be still. Right. And so I had that. Right. But as it relates to my diagnosis and treatment, I would often, when you talk about breath, there's lots of science behind it. A couple of things I would do. I would affirm to myself. One of the things I would say, and I still say, you can do hard things. Like, I just would repeat that when I was in a doctor's office, when I was going to get my stent, because I had to have a stent for the chemo treatment. When I got my lumpectomy, The stent and the chemo treatment were the same week. And that was difficult. I talk about it in the book, but I kept saying, you could do hard things. I would just say that to myself.
Say it again a little louder. You can
do hard things.
You can do hard things.
You can do hard things. You can do hard things. And there is neuroscience to say the soothing of yourself. And almost, I think I would almost rock. You can do hard things. You can do hard things. There's some science to that, right? Mm-hmm. And I would have the breath. I would be conscious of my breath. Mindfulness, you know, the Vipassana teaching is that I wasn't judging it. I was being aware of it, noticing it. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's shallow. Oh, it's okay. And then I would tell myself, well, it's shallow because you're scared. And it's okay to be scared. You're afraid. It's okay to be afraid. You want to cry. It's okay. It's okay. Like, I literally, not out loud, but that's what I would be telling myself.
While you were having treatment, would you do your practice? That's so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would. Well, honestly, when I would have my treatment, because of the cocktail they would give you, they didn't know if you would have an adverse reaction. So they generally gave you a Benadryl. So I would get sleepy. But yes. So there's a portion of the book where I talk about the first time I got the treatment. Can't remember what chapter that was. The first time I got the treatment, remember, I said I got the stent and my first chemo treatment in the same week. So they cut me open here. They put the stent in, not the stent, I'm calling the stent, port. They put the port in. Well, that's not healed. So say I think I got the port on Tuesday, I got my first treatment on Thursday. So what they do is there's a port. What they do is every time you go, you get they stick you with the needle and they put the IV into your port. Because ideally they couldn't keep putting in your veins because you run out of veins every time you went for treatment. And I went once every 3 weeks. So I had this unhealed port on my chest. And this lovely woman who you could tell she had been a nurse for a long time. Now this is you gotta get the book to deal with my parents and their foolishness. But it was a, I'm exaggerating, but it felt like the needle was this big. It might have been half of this, but it was pretty big. And she told me, this is after my mother had left the room and sent my dad in there because she couldn't deal. She didn't say she couldn't deal. She just was like, ah, I'm sending your father in. Ah, right. So he sat there and he is 75. So, no, he's 70. No, he's 80. He's 81. Silent generation, black man from the South. You can imagine what that was. He was just sitting there. He didn't know what to do, right? So he's sitting there because my mother told him to sit there. And the nurse says, this is going to hurt, but I promise you it will never hurt like this again. And so she proceeds to take this, what in my mind felt like this in my chest. And I was breathing all the while because I did, I was raised not to be hysterical, right? So my mother didn't take kindly to screaming and yelling and stuff. So I've never been like that. Reserve, you got this, right? And when the needle went into my chest, it was so painful that it shot literally through my whole body. And it hurt. I emotionally wanted to cry, but that is not what made me cry. It was the pain was so intense to me. Literally, I don't know if you've ever seen Glory with Denzel Washington, and he has that one tear that just goes down because he's too proud. Literally, that was my experience. I don't know if I was too proud to cry. It was just the most intense pain that I think my body had ever felt. Now, I haven't had children. I had never felt a pain like that. And I just sat there and cried. It was a physiological cry. Like my body just was like, your ass need a release. You need to cry. That's what it felt. And the nurse was right. It never hurt like that again. Partly because they put me on game, meaning they gave me put me on made me aware that you can get some numbing cream, right? What?
Yes, please.
Yeah. So after that, I think the second treatment, they were like, oh, you can get that. So then I began to get numbing cream and it wasn't a big deal. But that was my first experience getting the treatment. And yes, I did use my breath. I don't think I would have survived if I didn't, to be honest.
What do you think would have happened?
So I think there's so many variables to happen. My sorority sister had just been diagnosed, had just had a mastectomy shortly before I was diagnosed. And she's a nurse practitioner, PhD professor. Right, smart together. She has a, had a sister who had the same diagnosis of breast cancer that I did. Now, I at the time, who knew that there was different types of breast cancer? I didn't. Apparently there is. And so there is HER2 positive, which is what I had. And that means that it's a hormone producing cancer and it was receptive to chemo. Some people don't have that kind and it's not as receptive to chemo or not as receptive. And then some people have metastatic breast cancer. They're all different types of breast cancer. Didn't know it. Found out. So her sister was religious and chose not to get treatment. We were diagnosed at the same time, same type. by the time her sister decided to get treatment, she was like, oh, I'll get a lumpectomy. Now, it was too late. By the time her sister had chose to do something about it, as my sorority sister told me, because she was the one that was managing her end of life care, the cancer was so bad it had metastasized and you could smell the decay. No exaggeration. We were diagnosed at the same time. Now, I chose to get treatment. I know other people who chose to not get treatment and their cancer came back. Same type of breast cancer. So I'm saying, had I not had the wherewithal to practice breath, have us, you know, be able to sit down and meditate and to gather myself, I don't know if I could have emotionally withstood it, if that makes sense. Because it was hard. And I have to be honest, after treatment, my thinking changed about being empathetic with people who said they didn't want to get treatment. Because I was like, what do you mean? Now I understand. It's emotionally, physically bad. Now, I am fortunate. Everybody's diagnosis is different based on their age, based on their predisposition, based on every other thing they have going on with them. I was reasonably healthy. I had a physical movement. You know, I participated in things. I was, you know, I ate okay. You know, I didn't have a horrible diet. And I don't smoke. So I had a lot of things going in my favor. Other people might have a different route based on what they're dealing with. But emotionally, and I know the science of mind, body, and spirit, emotionally, I decided that I had to be a different person. And this is what I mean. You probably won't ever hear me say I had cancer. I never say that. I say I was diagnosed with cancer because I made a decision that I had to frame my thinking in that, okay, you were diagnosed. They took it out and they're giving you chemicals to make sure that it doesn't come back. But you don't have cancer. You were diagnosed with cancer. That's one thing that I took on. And then I almost had to become another person. So they told me my hair was going to come out. So what did I do? I went and got extensions because I knew that it was going to come out. So I went and got extensions. And then when I was getting a little closer to get the lumpectomy, then I had my girlfriend braid my real hair into what I call my African princess warrior braids. Because in my mind, I had to be a princess warrior. Now, as old as I am, I should have been a queen, but that's another story. I had to be a princess warrior. So I had to braid my hair in, like, you know, an African style tradition. And that's when I got the lumpectomy. And so then when I knew my hair was coming out, I was like, I have to be somebody else. So then I was like, you need a spiritual naming ceremony. So I went through a program and had a spiritual naming ceremony because in my mind, I constantly had to be someone else. So because my body had betrayed me in my mind. So I'm like, in order not to stay in that place and be Nicole Janine Atkins in the place of being mad at my body, because what did I ever do to you to deserve this? Or begin to think of things like, oh, well, you did this and this is why it's happening, which is nonsense. I was like, you will be somebody else now because this person is no longer useful for you. I don't even know if I was super conscious of it, but that's how I was moving. Again, would change my hair to be a different person. I had the spiritual naming ceremony and I never said I was diagnosed. I mean, never said I would have cancer. I always said I was diagnosed. Those are the things in my brain that I needed to get through it. Mm-hmm. Now, there's some things I probably should have did. I should have probably got some therapy while I was doing it. I didn't. I should have probably had a yoga practice during that time. I did it. So there's some things I could have done differently. But I knew in my mind I needed to do this. I needed to do this and be this person to get through this thing. Because, as I mentioned in the book, it's not just you that's diagnosed and has treatment. Mm. It's the people around you who love you, right? And so I have I used to call him my gentleman caller, which is funny to some people, a fella that I've been dating for a long time. And he was, again, it's in the book. He actually found the lump. And, you know, he was filling me up. And I was like, he was like, oh, what's this? I was like, oh, you know, my boobs are lumpy because some of us have fibrocystic breasts, right? Which is why they encourage you, if you have those type of breasts, to get a 3D imaging versus just a regular mammogram, because it's because it means your boobs are dense and they're just lumpy, right? And it could be exacerbated by the foods you eat. I had had a biopsy before because of my fibrocystic breast, but it was not cancerous. So I had been through this before. So when it happened again, I thought, oh, it's just my boobs, you know. But this time it was actually cancerous. And so when he did that, I was like, man, you know, I was sure I'm going to OBGYN. So she was like, oh, we'll send you, and hence the diagnosis. So he was there. Statistics show, and I don't know if it matters if you're married or if you're just dating, whatever, but that there's a high percentage of men who don't stay with women who are diagnosed. There's a decent percentage. We weren't married. He's still here. And yay, in that he's still here. He went through most of my appointments with me because we were privileged to be able to have jobs that allow for that. And what my sorority sister told me when I first called her, because he was the first person I called, she was the second, because I knew she would know what to tell me in order to what to do, what path to take. I didn't call my mother because my mother is a crazy person. And if I told my mother, she would have more questions and dictatorial things to say than I could withstand. So I didn't tell my mother until I had everything planned out. Because if when I knew, when I presented it to her, I needed to have answers, and I needed them to be short, and I needed them to be definitive, and I needed to be like, and this is what you're gonna do, and this is what I will not allow you to do, right? Because if I didn't, it just wasn't gonna work. And so my line sister, my sorority sister, she told me, she said, get two or three second opinions if you can. Get a binder. And she told me all the things to mark in the binder: oncology reports, radiology, nutrition, you know, all the things, so you can stuff them in there. So you can just pick it up and take it with you when you go to your doctor's appointments, because there's going to be a lot of information and you don't want to have to search around for it. What the best advice, the best, like a trapper keeper kind of thing. And she said, when you go to appointments, if you can, bring someone with you, because you're going to get a lot of information. Science supports this. You're not going to process it. It's going to go in one ear and out the other because you're under distress. Have someone come there and take notes for you, because you're not going to remember. And so my partner, that's what he did. He would come and he would take notes. To this day, he remembers things that I forgot, because I'll say, oh, this hard. He's remember they said that when you're on the medication, then I'll say, oh yeah, right? So I years later, he would remember things that I just didn't process them. And so though that was the best advice: get a trapper keeper. I'm 51, trapper keeper. I don't know if they even make those anymore. A binder. And if you're fortunate, because this is a privilege for me to have someone come to my appointments and take notes for me. And I know it's a privilege, because I would leave my appointments and I had insurance, again, a privilege. There would be people there waiting for transportation to pick them up. They were by themselves. That's what would make my heart hurt, because they don't have that support that I had. So I was privileged in that I had health insurance and I had overwhelming support of people who would do things for me. So I was lucky in that way.
Yeah, and a lot of these things, as I recall, are in the book.
Yes, everything I just mentioned is in the book.
I mean, all of that is such incredible advice. I love the note that you sent me in the book. That's really nice. Thank you. In chat, Jen White is asking, thank you for your bravery, authenticity, and vulnerability. You are inspiring.
For sure.
Not a question, but true. Second, did you ever get to a point that meditation was too emotionally intimate for you to practice, that to practice took you to a place that was too difficult emotionally to deal with? Really good questions.
Yeah, that is a great question. And I would say yes, because let's be honest, I didn't do a whole lot of meditation. through that time. I did some because, yes. Because, again, there's science and stuff about meditation and what the body can take and what it can't take. When you are forced with impending possible mortality, like we all know we're going to die. We all know that. But when someone says, hey, you might die sooner than later, just want you to know, your brain begins to function a little differently. And for me, who had been reasonably healthy most of my life, and a person who lived alone, it was heavy. So I would, when I had my first treatment, and I didn't take my meds like I should have out the gate. Another thing, don't do. Take the meds. I wasn't taking the meds right away because in my mind, I was invincible. And my body was like, you are not. And I had never had, this might sound silly, I had never had acid reflux. But the medications and all the stuff, all the combo of things, cocktail of things, gave me really bad indigestion. So when I would lay down, it was this acidy feeling and it felt like something was sitting on my chest. I literally thought I was dying. I literally thought I was dying because I had never experienced that. And I was like, oh, it has to be the chemo and my body can't take it. And, oh my God. And so I would go to bed at night and this sounds, you know, whatever, but I was like, I'm probably gonna die tonight. It was okay. Like in that moment, there would be times when I had this feeling of anxiousness in the body, because you know, you have that feeling, it resides in the body, the anxiousness and the fear. Sometimes I had that, but sometimes I was like, it's fine. You know, honestly, sometimes I'll be like, okay, it's fine. You know, my bathroom's clean, you know, I've cleaned the, like, there's not a lot of mess for people to clean up. It's fine. And then I would wake up in the morning, I'm like, oh shit, I'm still here. Okay. And then I would do it again. So to the point of, no, I could not sit in meditation sometimes because it was too overwhelming in my body to sit with that, which is why the open eye meditation years later is phenomenal, because it helps a little bit. Sometimes people just can't sit with it, period. But I definitely couldn't do it with my eyes closed. That, mm-mm.
Yeah. I get it in my own way. I totally get it. And there's something claustrophobic and I don't know, frightening about eyes closed. And when you're going through something traumatic, which you were, then you close your eyes. That's your vigilance has nowhere to go.
Yes.
And you're vigilant for a good reason.
Yes.
When your eyes are open, you're like, okay, I'm still here. I kind of get what's going on. And I think everybody probably knows, but the practice we do in the Open Heart Project is an eyes open practice, which is different. Mm-hmm. And it is also true, I'm sure many of you, if not all of you, know that meditation amplifies the inner state. It doesn't pacify it. That's one of the big misconceptions. I'm going to meditate because I want to feel more peaceful. Well, teach me that meditation when you learn it, because the one I know heightens everything.
That's right.
And so sometimes you just can't. So it's good that when you couldn't, you didn't.
Right.
Now, when you were meditating during your treatments on the times where it's made sense to do so, I imagine, although it could be wrong, that you just did that within yourself. Nobody knew. That was just something that was happening.
Correct. Yeah. Unless I was there, like if I would get undressed or whatever, and it was a short time before I had to go in, then I would do it when no one was there. Right. And I would have, you know, whatever my focal point was, and just notice.
My belief and my hope in the future, that will be normal, that your nurse will say, do you want to meditate for a few minutes? Do you want to do your practice? That it will be part of something that we all acknowledge is useful.
Yeah, it is.
You won't have to go shut it away somewhere in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thank God for nurses. Thank God for nurses.
For sure.
So if any of you have any other questions, please don't hesitate. I know this is very personal, and that's what makes it so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have any questions, don't be shy. You can raise your human hand, put it in chat, raise your digital hand. And this may sound like a trite question, Nicole, so forgive me if so, but you know, you go through hard things. And then first, well, before I get to my question, I love that you said, I love that you didn't say I have cancer. Mm-hmm. You say I was diagnosed with cancer. My stepson has juvenile diabetes.
Mm.
And he has never said, and we have never said, he's diabetic.
That's right.
Say he has diabetes.
That's
right. That is not all he is. And my husband is very, if I say, I think I have a cold, he says, no, you don't. You're fighting a cold.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've learned that from them. And that those things really make a difference.
They do. They do.
They really do. And I'm also really interested, well, this isn't my question either, but you created a new person.
Mm-hmm.
What, where is she now? And where's the person who was?
The person who was, so you can Google anything I'm saying. Some of this stuff sounds like I'm just making it up, but most of the stuff I say is evidence-based, right? And based in science somewhere. So, you know, our skin or our cells turn over X amount of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of creates a whole new person, kind of, sort of, in very basic way, not a very sciencey way that I'm articulating it. And I think for me, even if I hadn't gotten diagnosed, there are times in life that you're like, oh, this person needs to be put away. There needs to be a new person, because that person, it's time for that person to move on in a different space now.
Mm-hmm.
What a diagnosis like a cancer diagnosis does for you is, and what I think in my mind, and I know I'm judging other people, is like, how are you even the same person? I feel like, and again, I don't say it's my fault that I got cancer, but I want to change my mindset, my lifestyle, or something to be something different, because that wasn't serving me. And I just need to be something different. And it may change again. Like when I told you, when I turned 50, when I was turning 50, I was like, Nicole, you have to do scary things, because a diagnosis will get you together real quick, right? So the cancer diagnosis was like, oh, okay, I hear you, universe, God, whatever you, I get it. So there were some things that I straightened up on, right? And got a little better on, in terms of therapy, in terms of, you know, being introspective. Not always those things, but dived even deeper after the diagnosis. And then what happens is, I guess they say this is similar to being when you have a baby. The pain is super intense, apparently, when you have it. And so the further you get away, whatever it is, the chemicals in your mind allow you to forget. It gets a little more hazy. So you'll keep doing it again because you got to procreate, right? Whatever the science is. So I think the same thing happens when you have, for some people, like for me, I was like, oh, this cancer diagnosis, I got to get on it. I'm not going to live forever. And then the further you get away from it and you get back socialized into your usual stuff, kind of, sort of, you begin to kind of get far away. And so when I recreated myself with the diagnosis, that felt good. And I'm going to tell you something else that felt good. And I mentioned the book. When you have a cancer diagnosis, you don't give a shit. You don't give a shit, because you have been diagnosed with something that can kill you. So rushing to get a place or missing a deadline ain't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes mm-hmm. you can agitate in the grocery store or in the bank, whatever, and you're just short with people. Like I noticed at work, I just, you know, I've always been an intense, high energy person. It's just some stuff is just like, okay. That's what a cancer diagnosis did for me. The further you get away from it, the more you get back to, you know, the anxiousness of the world, right? The mm-hmm. hurriedness, the capitalistic framework in which we function, which mm-hmm. makes you act and do things in a certain way because you think you got to produce, you think you got to be fast, you think you got to do, but you don't. And when you're diagnosed with cancer, it's like, oh, I know I'm going to die. This might make hasten it up. So, I mean, is it really that big a deal?
Yeah. Just personally, I have not had cancer,
mm-hmm.
but I was in a bad accident a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I got hepatitis C from the blood transfusions. And I, years later, I did the treatment for hepatitis C. When I did it, it was a relative chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And it was a year of injections. And then I relapsed and I did another year. And it was, but it worked. It worked that second time. And then we have a question from Motor City Woman here. So just give me a moment. But I remember that 2 years that I was taking those medications, I also got acid reflux. I'm like, what is this? I was having a heart attack. I didn't know what it was. It was terrifying and very unpleasant. And all these other things happened that changed me physically. Like I couldn't tolerate spicy food, but mm-hmm. I loved spicy food.
Mm-hmm.
I became allergic to cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
Cardboard has some chemical in it that when I pick up a cardboard box, I get these raised welts on my arm. And I'm like, which one is me? Is it the one? Which one is me?
Yes, I know that experience, which is difficult to articulate. And mm-hmm. I don't even think I articulated very that much in the book. Weird things happen. So the acid reflux is a thing that happened. Sun, which I'm glad it didn't stay. The first time I started my treatment, because I had planned to go with my college friends that I've had for like 20, 30 years. We go once a year. We go to some resort. So we had planned to go to a resort. And I was like, I am still going to go to the resort. I was 2 weeks out from my chemo treatment. And I said, oh, you can still go. Nope, that's not the story. That's a whole nother story. The end of my chemo treatment.
Uh-huh.
I love the sun. Love it. I love the sun and I love the ocean. Those things I love the most. I was a sun worshiper and I would be out in the sun. The first time I went back out into the sun, like this sunbathe, I itched so bad. It was like I was allergic to the sun. It was the most horrifying thing because I was like, oh my God, I can't be in the sun anymore. It was horrifying.
Yeah.
It was horrifying. It didn't stay. I don't know what that was, but it went away. But to your point, the chemicals that they put in your body, I didn't have taste during the course of the chemo treatment.
Mm.
I couldn't taste anything except sugar and salt. It was the only things that really resonated. Mm-hmm. So the average person, not the average person, lots of people lose weight. I gained weight because I was too sedentary and comfort. I needed comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And I ate a lot of salty, sugary things.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, I would do something different. I would maintain a physical practice and I would be on a strict dietary thing. And I tried that for a little bit and it didn't work for me. So
yeah, look, what you're going through was so taxing and so demanding and P.S., you did friggin' great. You did great.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I did alter what I eat. When you're diagnosed with cancer and they tell you it's environmental, because I did have a genetics testing, by the way.
Mm.
And based on my age, I was 45, I was right on the borderline. And they were like, oh, we can give you genetics testing that would be covered by insurance to find out if I had the the BRCA gene. That's what they call it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. But that meant that my cancer was environmental. So what does that mean?
Oh, what does that mean? It's from
anything. It could mean anything. It can mean it's from the air. It can mean it's from the water. It can mean it's from the food. It can mean it's from what I'm putting on my body, what I'm putting in my body. It could mean anything. Mm-hmm. Environmental means just that. Anything in the environment that does not come from your genetics.
Interesting. Right? I didn't know that.
Yes. Yes. And so people say, oh, you know, runs in my family. It's less than 20% where it runs in your family. What runs in your family is lifestyle and where you live.
Oh, that makes
That's sense. What runs in your family.
That makes total sense.
Right? My auntie had it, my grandma had it. Well, you all eat the same. You all live in the same area.
Yeah, you do the math.
Yeah, right? So only 20% or less of folks have actual genetic, cancer.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's not
Motor City Woman in chat says, this is amazing and so transparent. Thank you for sharing your journey, Nicole. Are there any studies that outline the impact of mindset among people diagnosed with cancer?
Oh, for sure. you can, I mean, it depends on how academic you want to get, but there are studies that talk about mindset, because mind, body, and spirit are connected. So when people are depressed, or when people have low mood or whatever, it pushes down their immune system, their blood cell, the white blood cells, it's lower. So you're more susceptible to get sick. So yes, right? Your mental state definitely affects it. There are studies that show it. Now, you know, it depends on the study, depends on, you know, all the statistical facts and data, but there is study to show your mood and how you approach it and mindset affects how people heal or move past. That is true.
That's great. Yeah, and if people know of any things, studies, or that have been helpful to them, please
Yeah,
let us
please share.
know.
But they are out there. I try to keep the academic stuff away because I have two master's degrees and I don't want to do another.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
But yeah, there is some evidence-based practice, evidence-based stuff out there that says that for sure. And that's not just for cancer diagnosis, that's for illness in general. But I'm sure there's some that specifically point to a cancer diagnosis.
So this is the sort of maybe trite question that I was going to ask you. Who, I mean, this is also an impossible question, but who are you now that you don't think you would be without this diagnosis?
Oh. Yeah, I was getting to that and I got sidetracked because I'm the queen of going off on a tangent. I mentioned when I turned 50 to do scary things. I wouldn't be that person. I wouldn't be that person. I probably wouldn't be as forgiving. I'm pretty hard on myself. I wouldn't be as forgiving of myself or others. And I wouldn't do as many scary things as I do now. Right. I wouldn't have wrote this book and had my actual boobs out there and dare say anything that wasn't like awesome about my mama. And she's a good mommy. I say that. She's the best. But and I wouldn't have dared done improv. I wouldn't dare have tackled improv. I wouldn't have done it. And now not only did I take improv classes for a year, I'm in an improv troupe. Like I would have never done that.
That's so great. That's so great. That's so great.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you. And
Sure.
if anybody has anything else, we can go to the top of the hour,
Yep, you
or
can.
longer if necessary. But I just want to remind you all that Nicole wrote Book of Boobs, A Visual Journey Through Breast Cancer. And if you or anyone you know is facing this diagnosis, again, I said in the beginning, this is what I would want to know. It says, first of all, look at her sweetness. It has step by step the shock, the trying to get in the flow of what's going on, the pain of the treatments, and the reactions of family and her gentleman caller, loved ones, and the piece about mindset, I never had cancer, and affirmations don't make it go away. I really love that section too. And there's pictures of you at going on away with your friends, and pictures of your boobs, pictures of your head when you were starting to lose your hair.
Yep.
I mean, it's so brave, it's so generous, it's so amazing. Thank you,
There's
thank
something that I want to highlight in there, and you mentioned it, the affirmations don't make it go away. So I intermittently did journals, and I have an actual my own journal coming out, by the way, to
Oh, cool.
as a companion with Book of Boobs.
Well,
And
that's awesome.
the journal is titled You Got This Shit.
You got issues?
You got this shit. Like you got this. You
You
got
got
this.
this shit.
You got this shit. You got
That's
this. And
good.
I like to cuss. I think cussing, like, you know, just puts the cherry on top of a feeling that you're having. And I put it's a companion journal, but the reason I did the journal is because you have a lot of thoughts when you're diagnosed or after diagnosis. Cause still, 6 years later, I'm still like, You know, there's the kind of fear lurking, like it's gonna come back, it's gonna come back. Do you have enough time? Are you doing all the things, right? Because it pushes you. It pushed me. And so I was making a point about it. The affirmations don't make it go away. That's what I'm saying. The journal, I make it. But you can do the affirmations, which I think is healthy and you should do. But you still don't like people. You're still mad. Your body still hurts. It doesn't mean you don't do the affirmations, right? Just like when you go to the gym, right? I go to the gym now because I have menopause. And if I didn't go to the gym, I would choke somebody because that's just how my menopause is set up. So I go to the gym. Yes, does it make me look? The effects of it gives me some muscle tone? Sure. But I go to the gym because I have to do it to maintain my sanity. Same thing with affirmations. You have to do it because it's the same thing as building the muscle, changing the neural pathways in your brain and in your head to do it. It doesn't mean you still don't want to choke somebody. It doesn't mean you're still not mad. It doesn't mean the cancer is going away, you know, but it is helpful. And I think that's important for people to understand. Do the things because they help you. And there's evidence-based science that says it helps you. But it definitely doesn't make it go away. And I think I mentioned that in the book. Like, I just didn't like people. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I still don't like people. But like, I withdrew, which is why I probably should have had some therapy. I withdrew, which isn't healthy. Community is healthy for you. But like, I was like, you're stupid. I don't give a damn what your aunt did and how she dealt with. She drank cherries juice for a week and now she don't have cancer. I don't care. Like, you still gonna feel like that. And so I just want to lift that up. It's okay. And I've talked to other people who've been diagnosed and someone who has small children. And she was like, they always want stuff and I just can't get away. And excuse my, it's not French. And I was like, fuck them kids. Like, because you have to be here to survive. If you can't get a hold of what you need, you're not going to be no good for them. So take care of you first and let daddy figure it out. That's my approach. Again, I don't have kids. I don't have a husband. But I do know that self-preservation is the first key of survival. Your body is designed in that very way. Everything that your body does is designed to keep you alive, whether you know it or not. And it feels like it's betraying you, but everything that your body does is designed to keep you alive. So I think you've mentioned in the training of meditation, when people say, oh, you clear your mind. It's impossible. The brain is designed to think. So guess what the brain's going to do? Think. What you can do is bring your focus back to here. Acknowledge the thought, bring it back. And so that's just an example of the body is perfectly designed to do what it's supposed to do. Anything that happens to you that is adverse or you feel it's to preserve you. It's to keep you alive. Whether it's forgetting a memory, whether it's suppressed, it's designed to keep you alive. That's what the body's always fighting to do. Keep you at that homeostasis to keep you alive.
That is so important to remember. And your point about affirmations also, and it's not like there's a difference between redirecting your mind in a positive, strong direction and magical thinking.
Yes.
Or spiritual bypassing thinking. Like what you're going through is hard. So yeah, like you say, you can still hate people. You can still get angry. That doesn't mean you're doing a bad job. It just, you're a human being. And anything we do to try to navigate around that is not helpful.
No, because it's still going to be there.
Right?
Yeah, you can avoid it if you want to. It's not
Yeah. I remember, it's personal, but when I was doing those 2 years, that 2 years of treatment for hepatitis C, very different, but still I was just tired all the time and I had acid reflux and I was allergic to cardboard. I had no energy. I was just tired. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking, well, I'm just going to have to spend this time listening to myself.
Yeah.
I didn't really know how to do that.
Yep.
Just keep pushing. But anyway, it was instructive. So in chat, Jen says, Nicole, you say you have a bit more compassion for yourself and you are taking more risks. Mm-hmm. How has setting goals and planning things in the future changed?
So that's interesting. Because it sounds neat, right? So I'm the same person that quit my job like at the beginning of a pandemic with not a plan. I had a little bit of a plan. It's an exaggeration. Like, I had a little bit of plan to stretch me out a little bit. But, like, not really. I knew that what I wanted to do in my life, I wanted to live by my value of advocacy, social justice advocacy, as it related primarily with Black and brown folk. I knew I wanted that to be a value. I knew I wanted leadership development for Black and brown women to be a value. And I knew I wanted well-being to be a value. And what I mean by that is there are different models. You can get different academic models of well-being. Some of it is financial, some of it is emotional, some of it is physical. But if it didn't fit in those few things that I mentioned, I didn't want to do it anymore because I only have so much life left, right? And so I'm 50, I'm like, okay, girl, you got, you know, maybe more days behind you than you got in front of you, but that's okay. I want to do it doing stuff I want to do with people I want to do it with. And I can't always pick and choose the people, but I can curate it a little bit. And so I think that's how it's helped me towards my goal, is that this is what I told myself. I think I made a promise to me, myself, and God. I said, if I get past this and I'm still a whole, sane, reasonably sane person, it's okay if I don't go out here and try to save the world. I will save myself and pour into myself and allow what I pour into myself beam out onto the world and let that be it. Let that be it. Because I can't fix systems by myself. I can't fix the world by myself. What I can do is fix me. I don't need fixing. I remember that in your class, Susan. I don't need fixing. But what I can do is unpack and be curious about what my motivations are. That's what I'll work on. And I'll allow that to shine out. And whatever tools I pick up and put in my toolbox, I will share those tools and offer those tools so other folks can take with them what they want and unpack and be curious about themselves. I don't know if I answered the question, but that's how I approach like setting goals. I'm not really the best at being very goal oriented, but I am the best at saying, I don't like this anymore. I do like that. How do I get more of that?
That's great. It sounds like the overall experience, terrifying, uncertain, clarifying. So thank you a million times.
For sure.
And for people who want to stay in touch with you, people want to get on your email list to find out about You Got This Shit. Is that what the journal's going to be called?
Yeah, it's coming out eventually. Would you want me to put something in the chat?
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Let's see. What's the best thing to do? I'll do it.
And if you're watching the recording, we will put this in the email that accompanies the recording because you won't be able to see the chat.
Yeah, and you did a great job. And this is just my email address. That's the easiest thing to do. I'm not super fancy. I do have a personal website, but
great. And where can people get the book? I know that at the link you sent. So
Amazon. So I prefer, like, you can get it from my website. But sometimes the shipping is like annoying to me. And so I'll spare you with all of the details about that. But let's see. I know
because my books are on Amazon too, self-published, and okay.
You know.
I don't have anything to do with it.
Yep. So let's see this. Let's do this. Yep. See if that link works for Amazon. That'll take you straight to my
Yeah, perfect.
Yep. So that should work. And that's the better way to do it, because that way it's like,
Yeah, you don't have to sit there putting books in mailers.
Nope.
Yeah.
I don't make as much money, but it's kind of worth it.
It's a lifestyle choice.
It is.
I respect that.
It is.
Well, I thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you a million times. And I am so grateful that we know each other and that our paths continue to intersect.
Yes.
And I'm going to suggest that we, yes.
Because you know Keisha Battle too. Keisha Battle was like, hey. Keisha. I took her 300-hour yoga. Yes.
Keisha. I love Keisha. That's so great. She is so real.
Yeah.
So I'm going to just suggest that we formally close by just taking a moment to send well wishes to all who have been diagnosed, they do not have cancer, but they have been diagnosed with it, and that their healing journey may be as grounding and clarifying and enlivening as Nicole's was for her. So just take a moment, send that out. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, recording watchers. And thank you, Nicole.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you for allowing me to share. Bye-bye.
Bye.